Bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mahaj Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about hijab with Sheikh Javid, and some of the questions quite related to the issue of women, for example, driving cars. Sheikh Javid, what's the Islamic law about a woman driving a car?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no problem there's no objection to a woman driving a car. So it is, generally speaking, and according to Shia scholars, let alone Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, all Shia religious authorities, including His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that a woman can drive cars, it's permissible.
I see. Sheikh Javid, I want to ask you a very important and rather interesting question regarding women's dress in front of their mahrams. All right? We always talked about, in fact, women wearing this and that, or, for example, wearing hijab in front of, non-mahram, non-marriageable people, right?
Yes.
Or strangers, let's say. But what about in front of the mahram? What do women, or what should they wear? And what do you advise the women to wear, in fact, in front of their mahram relatives, in front of other women, for example, in their family gatherings and weddings, for example, or ceremonies?
Well, modesty is not only about going out and wearing clothes that are modest. Modesty means that one should be careful about his behavior, about his clothes. And when it comes to a woman, she should be careful about the dress she wears. She should not uncover her attractive parts, even if she's in front of her close relatives like brothers, like father and children, of course. That's why Islam says, for example, that when a brother and sister wants to sleep, it is necessary that they sleep in different rooms. And especially if it is feared that they might fall into a sin, they should sleep away from each other. Now, if it is very much likely that one of them might fall into a sin or into a haram act, then it is mandatory for them to sleep, separately from each other. They should sleep in separate rooms. When it comes to observing hijab, of course, the clothes should be modest and should preserve a woman's dignity and a woman's respect as a believing woman. As a believing woman, she should wear proper clothes. She should not, uncover herself. She should not when she is actually in front of her children or her brothers or father-in-law and so on and so forth. Now she must dress herself properly, lest the other family members or the male members of her family should not fall into a sin.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a very short break and we'll be back and continue our questions around the very important subject of hijab. And in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. And the subject is hijab. Well, Sheikh Javid, some women actually have beautiful or melodious voices. Yes. All right? And they are sometimes asked by the family members, in fact, to sing in front of them, for example, in some gatherings. Yes. Right? So some of them even recite poems during birthdays and mourning ceremonies. Some of them recite or they are asked to recite, for example, du'as or the Quran in a place where non-mahram cannot hear them. So what's the ruling on this issue?
So the assumption is that non-mahram cannot hear them, mm-hmm. Okay? In the event that non-mahram cannot hear a woman reciting poems or reciting the Holy Quran or supplications or maybe singing a religious song, there is no objection to her, It is permissible according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei.
Right.
But if she knows that there are non-mahram men outside and listening or hearing her voice, then it's not permissible to make her voice soft, attractive, and sweet, and charming, and because it's going to cause those men to fall into a sin or get attracted, and therefore she can recite and she can, for example, if she's reciting or if she's going to recite du'a or the Holy Quran, she can recite without making her voice attractive or pleasant or sweet or something like that.
I see. So when it comes to reciting the du'as and the Quran, even in front of the non-mahrams,
she can recite without making her voice, delicate, mm-hmm. attractive, sweet.
Just normal
soft.
Reciting or recitation.
Just like, for example, when she speaks to a non-mahram, how does she speak? She speaks in a normal way without making her voice attractive,
Yes.
The same is the case. She can recite the Quran without making her voice very much or attractive, or delicate or something tender, soft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Shastravid, another question, you know, somehow in a similar vein. When a person dies, a funeral ceremony attended by men and women alike are held in a courtyard, and a literate or educated woman sometimes recites the Quran and offers condolences in the women's gatherings, with men present in the same place hearing her. So what's the religious law about this?
Well, I haven't, you know, seen such thing. Maybe this is very much, this could be a customary
mm-hmm.
or something, a tradition practiced in some Arab Muslim countries. So generally speaking, a woman cannot, you know, recite in a melodious, in an attractive voice, anything, including the Quran, in the presence of men, in the presence of women. Of course, if no man is there and no one and no strangers is going to hear her, there is no objection to reciting something or you know, reading something out loud, and either in the form of condoling or extending her condolences to the family members, to the grieved ones, or in the form of reciting the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on how she recites the Quran and how she may be offering her condolences in the presence of other people, men or women.
Mm-hmm. A very quick question regarding the limits and restrictions regarding a woman's chat or her interaction with sister's husband and a brother-in-law. What are those restrictions or limits?
Well, a woman's conversation with non-mahram men should be without flirtation and without lustful intention. And she must understand that, for example, the example you give that, you know, the sister's husband is non-mahram,
mm-hmm.
and she's just like any other man outside the family, and therefore she is not to be treated as someone who can see her without hijab, who can see her without, you know, proper clothing. That's not the case. So the sister's husband remains non-mahram, and therefore it's very much necessary that observes, that she is careful about her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, a woman's voice is in and of itself is not aura. It's not something to be hidden. The woman's voice in itself, there is no objection to it. So it's not forbidden for a man to hear the voice of a non-mahram woman, unless, of course, it's done with the intention of lust or drive, seeking pleasure, or, you know, enjoying, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the answer.
I think. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Egypt is marking 100 years since the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun, a pharaoh who ruled more than 1,300 years BC.
I was fascinated with the story myself, and every morning in which I was here to pick up our inspector when I was working on a dig in the Valley of the Kings, I would wander around the house trying to imagine what it was like if I had been here in 1922 and could have been a part of that. And now here we are, now that it's restored. I do hope that this will turn into a center of cultural interest for anyone and everyone who wants to visit Egypt and wants to hear more of the story about Howard Carter and the king.
In 1922, British Egyptologist Howard Carter and his team discovered Tutankhamun's nearly intact tomb. That was the start of what became a 10-year project to excavate and conserve more than 5,000 unique artifacts. Tutankhamun's reign lasted barely 9 years in the vast span of ancient Egyptian history. Although his successors tried to erase the king's record from history, the valuable discovery of his tomb has immortalized the boy king.
China is taking the final step in the construction of its Tiangong space station, the second permanently inhabited station in low Earth orbit after NASA's International Space Station. The second and last lap component of the station was launched on Monday. The uncrewed module is called Mengtian, which means dreaming of the heavens. The rocket carrying it blasted off from China's Space Launch Center on the coast of the southern island province of Hainan. The 23-ton Mengtian is an advanced lab and does not have space for sleeping and sanitation. Instead, it has more space to carry payloads for scientific studies. Fan Ping is the chief designer of the project. She says this is a special step towards space research.
I think the Mengtian lab module is quite special, as it is for experiment only, which can be seen as a dedicated studio. There are 13 scientific experiment racks in the module and 37 exposed loading stations outside the module, enabling astronauts to do more extravehicular loading experiments in the future.
The Mengtian module is the last building block of the T-shaped Tiangong station. It has to fly 400 kilometers to join the two-module combination already dispatched into space. Together, the three modules will construct the station, which is designed for a lifespan of at least 10 years.
It's always a tricky task to remember people's names at a party, but not in this particular gathering in Tokyo, where all the guests had the exact same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. 178 Hirokazu Tanakas came together on Saturday to set a new namesake gathering world record. Their ages spanned from 3 years old to 80. The Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people with the same first and last name previously belonged to Martha Stewart. 164 people with that name came together in New York in 2005. In the Tanaka's gathering, every man was assigned an alias inspired by their hobbies, occupation, or favorite foods to tell them apart from others. One nicknamed by his birthplace says, "It's strange to meet so many people with the same name." Obviously.
It's a strange feeling to know that there are nearly 200 people with the same name. To be honest, I'd presume there are more popular names out there like Suzuki and Sato. This achievement is really because of the efforts of our organizer.
The man who organized this gathering is a 53-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka who has worked for years to make this happen. He says his quest began in 1994 when he stumbled upon news about a baseball prodigy with the same name. After that, he began tirelessly scouring the nation for his namesakes. He then founded the Hirokazu Tanaka campaign that brought the men together and created a strange friendship among them. Thousands of baby turtles have been released into Peru's Amazon basin in an attempt to preserve the rainforest ecosystem. More than 6,000 hatchlings of three endangered species of turtles have been released into lakes and lagoons in Peru to help them repopulate. To make this happen, wildlife officials collected the eggs from their natural habitat and transferred them to artificial beaches until they hatched. The river turtles are considered vulnerable because for many years they have been killed for human consumption or kept as pets. Scientists are currently trying to conserve the Amazon to avoid catastrophic climate change, and Peru has the second largest share of the rainforest after Brazil. Another world record news. This time it has been set in Switzerland. A Swiss railway company has run the world's longest passenger train with a trip on one of the most spectacular tracks through the Alps. To celebrate its 175th anniversary, Switzerland's rail industry launched the world's longest ever passenger train, measuring around 2 kilometers. The electric train took almost an hour to cover around 25 kilometers over the UNESCO World Heritage Albula line in eastern Switzerland. The Albula line is famous for its endless swooping curves and steep descents. Rail enthusiasts lined the valley to watch the train's 100 cars snake through the Alps. Belgium and the Netherlands were the previous record holders for the world's longest passenger train. They used standard railway through the flat landscapes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
If you enjoy street art, then you'll probably like Iztapalapa district in Mexico's capital city. Nearly 300 neighborhoods in this area are beautifully painted with brightly colored murals for all to enjoy. Visitors can also ride a cable car and take a tour of the art from above. The district is home to nearly 7,000 murals and graffiti painted on all sorts of surfaces, including rooftops. Iztapalapa Murals is a project that was promoted by the Mexico City's mayor in 2018. The goal of the project was to recover and dignify public spaces through art and involve neighbors in its creation and conservation. Iztapalapa is one of the poorest municipalities in the capital, and the initiative aims to reduce neighborhood violence through public lighting of the murals during the night.
It is never too late to learn a new skill. That's what 100-year-old Nada Rudan has shown with her art when she discovered her love for painting at the age of 87. The Bosnian native says she started to paint to keep herself busy, and now she finds the days are often too short to fit in everything she wanted to do. The artist paints for 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon without glasses. Rudan marked her 100th birthday with an exhibition of all the works that she has painted over the years.
My 100th birthday, I've celebrated it at sea. That was really a big event for me. Before that, I had an exhibition that I didn't hope for. But my children persuaded me. I was against it. I'm not an artist. I said, children, don't embarrass me.
She says she's inspired by nature and her travel around the globe. Rudan has lived in numerous areas such as Central America, Hawaii Islands, Europe, and the Asian Himalayas, among many other places. The artist survived both World War II and the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces. Iran's Kish Island is known as the paradise of the Persian Gulf. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali has been to the stunning southern Iranian resort island and has filed this report about its beautiful attractions.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. This snow town is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on 2 major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
A 78-year-old artist is making a comeback with a unique art installation on Governor's Island in the United States of America. One of its biggest features is the sound and creaking of moving chains.
It's a project that I proposed for a commission in St. Louis. The site of the commission was the area near the Mississippi River and the St. Louis courthouse. So I wanted to do a piece that addressed those areas and, you know, the subjects. And and of course we have those areas in the Mississippi River, which is a place that you talk about the history of American commerce, but also we can talk about the history of slavery.
Charles Gaines wanted to highlight the role slavery played in building the economy of the United States. That's why he purposely used chains, and the sculptor pointedly faces the Statue of Liberty in New York City. The installation is roughly 30 meters long and activated by colossal chains that rotate on anchors. The installation is part of a 3-chapter series called The American Manifest, Moving Chains. It will be kept for all to see until the summer of next year.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out 3 patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found a rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars and ulama all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziyaniya. Shaykh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite figure of the 14th century Hijra, who was an allama and alim in different fields of studies like fiqh, usul, philosophy. But mainly he is known for his studies in Islamic hikmah or philosophy. He is no one but Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafi'i Qazvini. Before anything, let's be more familiar with his early life and biography. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafi'i Qazvini was born in 1315 according to lunar Hijri calendar in Qazvin. Yes. And Qazvin is a city in the center part of Iran. He was born in a family that this family was full of scholars. Yes. His father, his mother, and his ancestors, they were scholars. And his grandfather, Mirza Rafi'i Qazvini, was amongst the greatest hukama and mujtahideen at his time. So that even this family is known as Al Rafi'i, you know, yes, the family of Rafi'i,
yes,
in Qazvin. And he started his, you know, primary Islamic studies in his city in Qazvin under supervision of his father. Even his father was his teacher.
Yes.
So after finishing his primary studies and getting a prominent knowledge in Islamic studies, he decided to move to Tehran to continue his studies. And then before his 30, he went to Qom, and he got benefit from Marhum Mirza Hasan Kermanshahi, Mirza Hashem Ishkevari. And the most important scholar that he got benefit from him regarding fiqh, jurisprudence, was Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, that was the establisher of the Islamic seminary in the city of Qom.
That's all right.
And we should know that when Asad Abul Hasan Qazvini was 30 years more or less, yes, at this age, he got the permission of ijtihad from Marhum Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi. And then he went back to his hometown and established the Islamic seminary of Qazvin and was in charge of that Islamic seminary for almost 30 years, trying to train good students in this field.
That's all right. But Sayyid Abul Hasan is known for his studies in Islamic philosophy and hikmah. And what is important about his outlook is that he did not consider Quran, Hadith, we can say, and Hikmah, and also Irfan separate from each other. And he tries to establish a kind of link between all three. This is really difficult, but as a continuation of the path of Mullah Sadra, and this, we can say, Hikmat-e-Sadra'i, he tries to revive
this type of thought in the houses and nurture some good students in this field of study. Sheikh Mahtawi, let's explain a little bit about this field of study, I mean Islamic hikmah and philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding the point that you mentioned, I think we have to clarify at this point that when we are saying that such a scholar has done or has achieved such big achievement in terms of philosophy or irfan or mysticism or hikmah whatsoever, we may give this title, although there are differences when we are going to talk specifically about any of these fields of study. By the way, we have to know this, that such great scholar, before they come to that point, they have created a lot of works in those fields of study. For example, this alim or scholar that you just mentioned, when we look at his works, we see that he has a lot of commentaries on important books in Islamic philosophy like Al-Manzuma, Al-Asfar, Al-Arba'a, Shawarigh al-Ilham, Yes, I just wanted to say, when you look at the type of the books he has written his commentary on, you see these books are coming from the two, at least, distinctive field of philosophy. I mean, one which is Hikmat-e-Ishraq and the other which is Hikmat-e-Mashah.
Yes.
So this is what we believe that has been done in Hikmat Muta'aliyah, meaning merging between these two sides. One side is totally, just let's say this way, one side which is coming from Hikmat Ishraq is totally based on intuitions and more metaphysical reasons. And the other side, which is coming from the Mashah field of study in the philosophy, is coming from the mere reasoning and intellectual reasons.
Yes.
So to merge these two fields of study, to have one hand being full with the mystical and intuitions and the other with the reasons, and then merging these two in order to create new fruits and results in terms of the philosophy, this is something that for the first we may call Mullah Sadra.
Yes.
Who initiated this school of thought. And then for such students who are alim themselves, they continued this way.
That's right.
So after creating so many commentaries on different books in both schools of thought, we see how they generated and created and developed their type of understanding following their scholars and masters.
That's right. So we can call it a third, we can say, type of thought in the Islamic philosophy, the Sadra one, and say that Hasan Rafi.
That is the new approach.
The new approach.
Yeah,
okay.
This is the new approach. Totally. When you go through Hikmat Muta'aliyah, you can't say it's totally coming from the Hikmat Ishraq, and you cannot say it's coming totally from the Hikmat Mashah. You see that it is kind of merging between these two fields of study, which are the famous ones in Islamic philosophy.
And usually the people, Sheikh Ziyaniya, think that the Shiite ulama are only concerned with Quran, Hadith, and Fiqh, and not philosophy. What does make, for example, an alim interested in the field of philosophy in the religion of Islam? For example, starting with Mullah Sadra or getting to Allama Tabatabai, Ayatollah Hassan Zada Amali, Allama Sha'rani, and Sayyid al-Hussain Rafi'i Ghazmini. Why interest in such a field? I mean, what is the fruit of studying philosophy or hikmah for an alim from a hausa?
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Fussilat, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, sanurihim ayatina fil afaqi wa fi anfusihim hatta yatabayyana lahum annahu al-haq. Awalam yakfi bi rabbika annahu ala kulli shay'in shahid. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will show his signs to humankind in the universe, in his creation, and also in the human being's inside part, I mean his soul.
So
when we want to talk about this verse, we should know, okay, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us, you know, his signs through the creation. So here we need to understand the creation correctly. And then we may call it epistemology.
Yes.
That you should try to understand the universe. Philosophy is in charge of this. So if you want to analyze the being or al-wujud in philosophy, they say.
Yes.
So you are talking about epistemology or about the universe.
Yes.
That Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying that through this, you will find your Lord.
That's right.
So that's why philosophy has a very important role in, understanding religion.
Yes.
And also, finding signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
right.
in our lives. Beside this, something that is very important regarding Islamic philosophy is that when in Western culture we discussed about philosophy,
yes,
we try to talk about the universe that is cut from its origin.
Uh-huh.
It's something that is there. Now we want to analyze it.
Yes.
But we do not want to go through the beginning of this creation. Mm. We just want to say that, okay, let me say, they just want to say that, okay, there was a big bang and something was happened, and then
yes.
the universe was created.
Or it's better to say that the materialistic world is the concern of the Western philosopher, especially from Enlightenment period onward.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me tell you this, that this materialistic civilization that
mm-hmm.
nowadays is,
yes.
We are seeing it
mm-hmm.
in, Western world
mm-hmm.
or throughout the
yes.
world, is the fruit of Western philosophy.
Yes.
So that philosophy analyzed the epistemology or discussed epistemologically,
mm-hmm.
then prescribed a version of living for human being.
That's right.
So now this is the fruit of
Based on worldly life.
Yeah.
Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
But in Islamic philosophy and Islamic hikmah, Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafiq Azmini is the teacher in which there is a direct connection between the divinity and the life.
Yeah.
And the philosophers in Islam, including the fuqaha and the others, are concerned with the, we can say, divine aspects of the life of the human
sure.
being. That's right.
So okay. that's why even some people, they would say that Islamic philosophy in this sense
uh-huh.
is somehow far from the pure philosophy that is discussed in
mm-hmm.
Western culture.
Okay.
Because they say philosophy is the soul and pure, intellect.
Yes.
Of course, the problem is that intellect is not, prominent enough.
Yes, complete.
To discuss about
yes,
everything.
Yes.
So that's the problem. That's when the problem comes to the
that's
issue.
Right.
So in Islamic philosophy, they try to block this problem through connecting philosophy to
mm-hmm.
divine knowledge.
Can it be called really a type of philosophical approach? Because as Sheikh said, in philosophy, in the Western world, we are completely concerned with the intellect and the power of rationality.
For sure. When you refer to their foundations, the way they are thinking, the way they are considering the issues, you see how they are employing all of the philosophical issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they are taking advantage of all of those philosophical pillars and principles, then creating and developing a new approach in order to get the fruits they are looking for based on the religious tendencies
yes.
and approaches that they have.
That's all right. But still, there is an opposition toward philosophy or learning philosophy or something like that, because some believe that it gives priority to intellect rather than, for example, spiritual power, Quran, Hadith, or so. So what's your answer to that? For example, people like Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafiq Azmini, Allama Tawatabu, even the late Imam Khomeini, who was interested, I think, in Islamic Irfan, mysticism, and philosophy.
Okay, if you are asking my personal
yes,
approach
yes.
upon this, I would like to say this way, that as long as we can take advantage of philosophy
mm-hmm.
and logic in order to understand Quran and Ahadith,
okay.
that is helpful.
Okay.
And that is totally agreed upon.
Yes.
But if you want to only go for philosophy for the sake of philosophy. Mm-hmm. That is the moment we see that we are going to be, at the end of the day, we are going to be, yes, okay. Nothing is in our hand. Why? Yes, because we have Quran and Ahadith. Mm-hmm. We left them aside and then we only hold on to the philosophy because of the philosophy.
Okay, that's right. And Sheikh Ziyaniyah, what's your answer to this question?
You know, all the discussions in religion are not solely, you know, related to the discussions that are inside religion. Because when we want to discuss religiously, we should prove religion at first. And the first concept that must be proved in religion is God. Mm-hmm. And then how you want to prove God? You need to have intellectual approach. And this intellectual approach is available in philosophy. So philosophy is useful beside, you know, the issues, the discussions that are, you know, giving us benefit in the issues that are internal issues in religion. Beside that, philosophy is a necessity for the discussions that are out of religion, but religion is in need of them.
That's right.
But so this, you know, intellectual approach is, you know, in essential need of philosophy. And of course, we may say that philosophy is not the only thing that helps us here, but is one of the basic issues that we should use it. And if a person, a scholar, learns philosophy in a good way, then he may defend religion from this point of view.
Okay.
Of course, we may say that here philosophy would come, you know, close to theology or ilm al-kalam.
Yes.
But if you use the pure intellect, then it's not, the intention is not that important, because your manner is the issue that is important in philosophy. So let us look at the method that Islamic philosophers are using. Mm-hmm. Are they using pure intellect or not? If they are using pure intellect, you know, the in the discussions that are out of religion or are the introduction to the religion, so it's a philosophical issue.
That's right. And this approach, I think, must be encouraged in comparison to the so-called Muslim philosophers who give priority to intellect and under the shadow of intellect are giving the so-called modern interpretation, for example, out of Ahadith or the Holy Quran, or, for example, the mechanism of revelation or Wahy or something like that. I do want to say there is a difference. A person who considers intellect under the shadow of spirituality and divinity and vice versa.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyaniyah and Sheikh Mahdavi, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafi Ghazvini, one of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite faqih and philosophers of contemporary Iran. Muharram 1st, 1395, according to the Hijjah calendar, he passed away in Tehran. At the age of 85, his body was taken into Balasar Mosque in the holy city of Qom, in the holy shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masuma, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, An Introduction into the Life and Works of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Rafi'i Ghazvini. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
که این صفت مخصوص زن نیست اما چرا حضرت برای زنان خواسته چون
chastity and honor is not limited to women only. However, Imam al-Mahdi in a supplication asks Allah to give women such attributes. But why? This is because if a woman is deviated in a society, the whole society will be deviated. Thus, if a woman in society is deviated, the man of that society will be deviated too. The moral downfall of the women will make a society deviated too.
زن اصلا محور تربیته.
Woman is the pivot of moral nurturing in both family and society. If a woman is deviated morally, then the man is deviated too. That's why all our infallibles, especially Imam al-Mahdi, ask Allah to give the women of a society the sense of chastity and honor. This way, a society can develop spiritually too. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Everything has been carefully planned for the annual New Year's greetings ceremony to the king. Government officials are all standing in line to perform the tradition of kissing the king's hand. But it seems someone special is absent from the ceremony. Iran is shocked and stunned with the news of a suicide. The suicide of well-known Qajar commander, Colonel Fazlullah. No one knows how the prime minister was notified of what had happened, but everyone saw his hasty exit from the New Year's greeting ceremony. First person who arrives at the scene is then Prime Minister Vosukhodole. His presence at the Colonel's house is not that strange. What's strange, though, is that he personally inspects the scene and does not issue the burial permit until the discovery of the Colonel's letter before he committed suicide. It's now 9 days since the beginning of the new year, but the colonel's suicide has still not been reported to the public. Finally, after 10 days, Vosukh allows the coverage of the event, but only Ra'ad newspaper is allowed to publish it, without mentioning a motive for the suicide. You have to look for the answer to the riddle in the note that the colonel had written before killing himself. What is the motive of the suicide? Why does Vosukh prevent the publication of the news? The answer to these questions invites us to an exciting journey, a journey among historical records and documents. Media outlets which support the government try to circulate word that the suicide had a personal motive, and on the other hand, Vosukhodole has peace of mind that the people and media do not have access to the colonel's last letter. Until a document discovered at the mortuary shatters all of Vosukh's calculations. A note soaked in blood in Colonel Fazlullah's shirt pocket. This document proves rumors that the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah and the agreement were related. Of course, it wasn't very difficult to confirm the connection. Less than 2 months since the publication of the agreement has passed and the British delegation enters Tehran. A delegation led by this man, General Dixon, an experienced officer in the British Army. Their mission has been defined, the establishment of a committee for the implementation of this article of the agreement. An article which lifts military sanctions on Iran and insists that it establishes a uniform military force. The meetings of the committees are held at this place with the presence of Colonel Fazlullah as the representative of Iran's army. During 4 months of talks, issues like the purchase of weaponry, of course from India's army, the unification of military forces, and the training of Iranian officers are discussed. But the results of lifting of the military sanctions is the purchase of light and used weapons remaining from World War, something that creates disagreements within the committee.